Nothing is Real, a Beatles podcast, is powered by Acast. Welcome to Nothing is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin and Belfast. In December 1964, the Beatles dropped Beatles for Sale, their fourth album in 21 months. In the USA, it never really came out at all. The songs were instead spread across the Beatles 65 and the Beatles 6 albums. And over the years, it's a rare thing for someone to say that it's their favourite Beatles album. However, are the rumours that it's a subpar, nay, the worst Beatles album, even fair? I don't think it's fair. Do you think it's fair, Stephen?
No. This is an album that I only came back to quite recently. It's not an album I listen to very much, and I would probably have said, with the exception of Yellow Submarine, it might be my least favourite Beatles album, but listening to it again, I think I'm revising that opinion.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, I've been, you know, before coming in to talk about it today, I've kind of gone back and listened to it again, and it's you kind of wonder, well, where does it get this reputation from that it's not very good? It's, you know, they never did anything that wasn't completely poor. Maybe you could say it's their worst, but it's still a lot better than anything that was happening at the time. And as we say, they were Beatles, they were an album's act from the start. It still hangs together as an album.
It does. And I mean, I'm not even convinced that it is their worst. I think the reputation, as far as I'm concerned, is that it seemed to be a step backwards from A Hard Day's Night, in the sense of, you know, they reintroduced covers. Each album had been a progression to that point, those first three albums. And then suddenly this seemed to be slightly stepping back into the world of covers. Did they not have enough original songs? You know, and certainly I think there was a little bit of a perception of that at the time. And then it gets drowned out in the subsequent sort of fascination with all things Revolver, Pepper, White Album, Abbey Road.
I do
the early albums as a group don't get the same attention, I think.
I think you're right. And I do think one of the problems is that there's no US equivalent. So there's no memory of it in the US for people to champion. Yeah. So it kind of in that massive market, you know, it disappears. It eventually appears on compact disc in 1987 in the US when, you know, the albums are all standardized, but there isn't a generation of kids who grow up rooting for Beatles for Sale, you know, so that's one problem. I think another problem is, you know, when I was getting into the Beatles, you know, I was going through Lewison's Studio Sessions book, and that book is quite, I wouldn't say scathing, but it's pretty down on Beatles for Sale. It says, you know, it's a dour album. It's not great. Mr. Moonlight is terrible. You know, oh, well, another album came along. Don't worry about it. It doesn't. I kind of approached Beatles for Sale when I first got it with the notion that, oh, this is the bad one. And I think that's stuck with it for a long time.
Yeah, it's like Wildlife. It wears its reputation very heavily.
That's, I think we could wrap it up there. This is the Beatles.
This is the Beatles Wildlife. And thank you for joining us this evening. I think that's exactly right. There is a sort of consistency in this slightly dismissive tone.
Yeah.
And the focus always seems to be, you know, don't they look tired on the cover? And the focus is on the number of, you know, the what they've done in the previous 12 months or the previous 10 months, where there's films and there's tours and there's albums and there's singles, and boy, don't they look worn out on the cover. So I think all those things combine.
You can certainly project onto Beatles for Sale and say, you know, well, you can pull out these reasons and say, yes, there are covers and there weren't any on the previous record, and it's, you know, it doesn't match up with some of the other things. But coming back to it in the last couple of weeks, particularly in you know, before recording today, I have totally rethought how I feel about it. And, you know, we're going to touch on some of that during the cast today. But what we might do first is look back on 1964, because although without, you know, you could do a whole series on the year itself, it might be worth making a couple of pit stops just to get an idea of how busy they were that year, and, you know, what their kind of set lists were in their live acts at the time. So the first pit stop that's probably a good one to make is maybe back in January 1964, and they are in Paris and they're doing a series of gigs in Paris. And it's at this time that in the States, I Want to Hold Your Hand is slowly or not slowly, very quickly climbing up the charts.
Quickly, yeah.
So what are they up to in Paris?
Well, they're actually, I mean, France was pretty slow on the uptake, I think, with Beatlemania. You know, Germany, Sweden, even America. When America fell, it fell hard and it fell very fast. But the French were always slightly resistant. So they're playing 20 days at the Olympia Theater in Paris. And they're playing two or sometimes three sets a day.
Yeah, it's very strange that, you know, this was Epstein's, considering how spread out they were, that they had such a significant, like 3 weeks out of the 52 weeks were spent in Paris in one theater doing these shows. That's quite a significant chunk of time for them.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously there is an audience. If you, you know, if you're going to book 20 days, that's 40, 50 shows is what they're playing. Obviously the audience is there, but I don't know whether it was a concerted attempt to break the French market or that was seen as the sort of foothold into the rest of Europe. It is strange, and I haven't seen any analysis or any explanation as to why the 20 days are block booked in one city at one theater. I mean, you know, short of the Christmas shows, I don't think they've done anything comparable elsewhere.
Yeah, that's what they've done. And they came to Paris off the back of the Christmas shows, and they were in Paris from the 16th of January to the 4th of February. And they did a very short set list. So we've got a set list here. It's kind of amusing. Eight songs, From Me to You, Roll Over Beethoven, She Loves You, This Boy, Boys, Ringo, I Want to Hold Your Hand, Twist and Shout, and Long Tall Sally. That's it. Eight songs, in and out. That's their set list. And then
back to the hotel.
Back to the hotel for tea. And they're in Paris when they find out that they're number one in America. And that's the starting pistol for a whole ton of insanity.
Yeah. Really. Yeah. I think this is sort of physically where they were when that starts.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of discussion, you know, that was that American trip booked before number one? If you look at Anthology, you get one of them, George, I think, is saying, oh yeah, we were going to go to America, we were always going to go to America. And I think it's Paul that says, well, we weren't going to go to America until we had a number one single. Yeah. So but this is where it all starts suddenly to kick in.
And you can go back and listen to our season one episode about I Want to Hold Your Hand, where we kind of go into those weeks in a little bit of deep detail. So that's snapshot number one. They're in Paris, they're doing these block of gigs, they find out they're number one in America, and there's that picture of them all hitting each other with pillows on the bed when they find out that they're number one. Snapshot number two in Paris, you know, they go through Ed Sullivan, they film A Hard Day's Night, but then the next snapshot is June and their first world tour. And this is, you know, again, we talk a lot about how the Beatles kind of were in uncharted territory, that they were, you know, trying to make up the rule book as they went along. So it's kind of striking to see, okay, well, here's a band going around the world. This wasn't really a common thing outside of, you know, you'd get some of your rock and rollers traveling over to England for a series of dates, you know, the mainland Europe for a series of dates. But to try and do a 1 month world tour is pretty wild. And this is where the famous tour where at the start Jimmy Nicol gets drafted in.
Yes. But yes, you're right. I mean, the history here is they are initially having to work within an existing sort of showbiz setup. So you've got provincial theaters, you've got clubs, you've got, you know, whether it's the Star Club in Hamburg, and they're working within that format. Then they're playing in the UK, they're playing in cinemas, they're playing in theaters, but they very quickly outgrow that system. So as you say, there isn't really a roadmap here, and you know, when they turn up in cities on this tour, there's hundreds of thousands of people are turning out just to see them get off the plane or drive to the hotel. And this is unprecedented. You know, the figure that sort of precedes this is Elvis.
Yeah.
You know, he was eliciting this. He didn't tour. He didn't do world tour. He never left America to tour. So yeah, they're setting out. This is completely uncharted territory.
And they're going out across Denmark, the Netherlands, Hong Kong, Australia, New Zealand. Later in the year, they go back to the US, but they're doing that chunk of the world. And this is the tour where, at the start, Jimmy Nicol is there. And at the start of that tour, when they have a few hours to practice with Jimmy Nicol, some of the seeds of Beatles for Sale appear, because that's where we get the first demo of No Reply, the one that turns up on the Beatles Anthology.
Yes, yes. So again, we touched on this on a previous episode, but they rehearse for one day with Jimmy Nicol.
Yeah.
They do six songs out of what will be a 10 song set list. And then 27 hours later, they're playing their first gig in Copenhagen. But during this session, they do this demo of No Reply. And the assumption is made that this is George, John, and Paul. And, you know, Jimmy Nicol doesn't appear on this.
Yeah.
The other song that was recorded, and I only came across this recently, the other song that was recorded at this was You Know What to Do,
yeah,
which is the George Harrison demo.
And that's on Anthology One.
That's on Anthology One. This is not mentioned in Mark Lewis and Sessions because the tape was misfiled.
Yeah.
So when that book came out, nobody knew this tape existed. But yes, that's another song that sort of disappeared until Anthology. So even you would think if you are rehearsing for a world tour with a drummer
who you've just met,
brand new to the band, you've just met, you might spend a little bit more time rehearsing and not think, you know what, we've done six of our 10 songs. He'll be fine on the other four. We'll just knock off a couple of demo tracks here as well. Yeah. But yeah, it's very strange.
So that's snapshot number two, the world tour. Snapshot number three, then, maybe to get an idea of how busy they were, is July 64. They have their debut film, A Hard Day's Nights. They've managed to squeeze in the making of a film. You know, there's all the attendant, you know, premiere work, but there's also the Hard Day's Night album, and the main album, you know, the US has a 7-track version with incidental music, but the main version of the album is 13 songs, the 14th song apparently missing because they were rehearsing with Jimmy Nicol, but 13 songs, and it is the only album of all Lennon McCartney originals that they ever get around to releasing, because even George doesn't squeeze one onto the album at that point. And that's another great achievement, to actually manage to pull off a wholly original album in the middle of an insanely busy year, and a very high quality album.
Yes. I mean, it's probably, you know, to my money, it's the best of those early albums.
Yeah.
It's certainly the one that I would go back to. And I think probably it represented such a leap forward in terms of the sound and the production, and there's a maturity to the writing there.
Yeah. So that's a snapshot of how busy they are. So they've had a very busy January to July 1964. The first songs that get recorded then for Beatles for Sale happen in August 1964. And the first set of sessions come about before they go off to tour the US. And so the recording starts on the 11th of August, 64, and there's four songs that get put down for the album first. So the first one is Babies in Black on the 11th of August. Now, I know you're laughing because I know you don't really like Babies in Black.
It's not that I don't like it. I loathe this song.
Is this your least favorite Beatles song?
This could be my least favorite Beatles song.
Why?
I can't hear it without thinking of...
this is going to ruin it for everyone.
Yeah. You know those things when you were a kid in music class and in, you know, primary one or primary two, and they gave you a recorder and they made you play Johnny's So Long at the Fair. You know, oh dear, what can the matter be?
Yes,
it's just this kind of nursery rhyme. And, you know, although it's only a whim, she thinks of him. You know, the lyric is very trite.
But
the tune is what is it? I'm reliably informed it's in 6/8 time.
Okay,
it just seems very awkward. It doesn't kind of flow. It's kind of jerky. But this song was in their live set list for the next 3 years.
That's what I was going to say.
They love this song.
Yeah, you see them like that. Does it get played in Candlestick Park?
I think it's certainly there are terrible recordings of them playing it in Japan.
That is true. And it's but it does have one of those great kind of high Paul harmonies that kind of just creates that third Beatle note, you know. That's a great moment.
But I just think it's very it's very contrived.
Yeah.
It's very 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 trite. It's very downbeat.
Yeah, you know? And it kind of comes on the back of, I kind of see it in the, it's sharing DNA with kind of This Boy and Yes It Is and those kind of songs, you know. It's
again, I think I'm on record as saying I'm the only person in the world that doesn't care for Yes It Is.
Yes It Is, yeah, yeah. Well.
Yes It Is.
Okay.
It's true. I just, that doesn't, it just, it, I suppose, is it a folk element to it.
So you don't like folk music. Well, that's fine.
No, I love folk music.
So Babies in Black is put down. Is that a John and Paul kind of nose-to-nose co-write? Is it?
This is supposedly a co-write that they wrote at John's house.
Which may or may not be about Astrid.
May or may not. They've never claimed that it was about Astrid or acknowledged that it may have been about Astrid. I think that's just people projecting.
Yeah.
Because they know the history there with Stuart Sutcliffe. But I don't think anyone has ever mentioned that.
Fair enough. And so the next song then they put down is I'm a Loser. Now you don't hate I'm a Loser.
I love this song. This is a great song. Supposedly this was actually considered at one point as a single.
Yeah,
and I think that would have been a fantastic single.
Yeah.
Also, extremely uncharacteristic.
It does. When you start thinking about how the order that these songs are recorded in, for that kind of to be brought in pretty early, you kind of think,
yes,
all right. So this change is happening in August 64.
Yes.
This kind of
yes.
I'm a Loser is the path on the road to help, in a way, and all the other kind of self-reflective Lennon songs.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And it's also this you know, Lennon at this stage is hanging out with Mick Jagger, with Eric Burdon. He's kind of picking up this folk blues. We've got this country and western element coming in. You've got Dylan's influence coming in. All of those things come together, and it's a fantastic vocal performance as well.
It really is. I kind of think. Yeah, I mean, it ends up being the second song on the album. You know, could it have been the opening song on the album? Maybe it's a bit too downbeat. And
well, the running order on this album is very interesting. You know, we maybe touch on that when we get
to the big release
song.
Yeah.
But it is very downbeat.
And it's also interesting to hear the word loser, you know, because you kind of think loser is a bit of a 90s Beck kind of.
Yeah,
hey, you're a loser.
Yeah,
it's odd to hear that idiom.
Yeah, and you've got ostensibly the leader of the most successful band in the world.
That's true. Yes,
saying, you know, I'm a loser.
Yeah.
It is. It's strikingly modern.
And then the next song to get recorded is everyone's favorite track on the album, Mr. Moonlight.
Yes. Yes.
Do we need to say anything more about Mr. Moonlight?
No. I think we can say take four was marked as the best one, and maybe we'll come back.
Well, what do you think about Mr. Moonlight? Because Mr. Moonlight again. You know, Lewison's recording sessions book, I think that's the song that he points towards being not like the worst part on this so-called worst album. When I first listened to the album years and years ago, I thought, yeah, that is a terrible song. And now I kind of like it. I think it's kind of funny.
It's funny. And I suppose it all depends on how you take that keyboard solo.
Yes. But the keyboard solo, here's what I'll say in defense of that kind of keyboard solo. It's a sound that doesn't appear in any other Beatles record at any other point. So you could say it's a sound that they've pulled in, they use it, they see what it's like, they leave it on this song, and then they just go on to the next thing. We worry about it more than they do.
But presumably there was an erase button. They could have erased it.
Yeah, I suppose so. But can't you imagine, was it Paul who played the organ?
Of course.
Yes, because you can imagine it sort of has that air of, Paul, I can do everything. Here I go, playing the organ. Yeah. You know when he does that I'm going to show you how a Mellotron works. And he, sort of reeks of that, doesn't it?
Every time I hear it, I just think of, the organist in Monty Python.
Yes.
I'm not suggesting Paul
was in the nude.
This robe.
No.
It was this robe. No, I think if you listen to the version on Anthology, and I think it has its reputation simply because of the keyboard solo, the organ solo.
Yeah.
If you listen to the unadorned version, it's another fantastic vocal performance by Lennon.
Yeah.
And it's a good song. It's a perfectly serviceable song. I think it's just this kind of cheesy organ that and there seems to be some debate was it intended as a joke or was it a serious?
Yeah, I think, Mr. Moonlight sort of, if I said to you, I think it's Decca Audition Beatles, that's kind of what it is.
Yeah.
And it's John's A Taste of Honey. That's what kind of Mr. Moonlight is.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just, it's kind of odd to hear John in that role of maybe plucking out a song that's a little uncool. But I think it's in that lineage.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So Mr. Moonlight is recorded on that day. And then the next song they record is Leave My Kitten Alone, which becomes this great...
Great lost
Beatles song. This was pre-anthology. This was the kind of the bootleg rarity.
This is the rumor, you know, we've got a complete take. It's great. People who'd heard it were saying, oh, this is absolutely fantastic. It's a fantastic vocal performance. And I think that one of the things that comes out across all of these sessions is just Lennon's commitment in terms of the vocal performance.
Well, that is the thing about Beatles for Sale. It is a Lennon album.
It's very much a Lennon album.
There's very little Paul really on it. Compared to where we go to in following years. It's solid Lennon, you know, and particularly coming off the back of A Hard Day's Night, which is also a solid Lennon. Yeah. A lot of solid Lennon work on that as well.
I think this is probably the peak of Lennon's, I don't want to say control, but sort of the direction control is the right word.
Yeah.
This is certainly his peak. And I think it's maybe Ian MacDonald in Revolution in the Head said this is because Paul was out squiring Jane Asher and he was in the first flush of romance there. And so he sort of took his eye off the songwriting ball.
Yeah, which is not like him, obviously. So Leave My Kitten Alone, though, doesn't come out. And, you know, it gets remixed later on for other purposes. But should it have been there? Should it have been on the album?
I think it should have been. There is a particularly weak song later on the album that we'll come to. And I think this could have... There may be one or two tracks that this could have been substituted for. It's an excellent performance. You were saying it was remixed in 1982.
Yes,
for the Beatles at Abbey Road video presentation, which I think is where the bootleg
industry kind of spawned from that.
Kicked off from that. Yeah. The Sessions project in 1984, Jeff Emmerich remixed it there, and then he remixed it again for Anthology in 1994, and it came out in 1995.
Yeah.
So I mean, you get the sense that EMI knew what they had here. You know, they knew it was a complete take, unlike the other tracks in Anthology, which are sort of take one fades into take three. And they think
this is a real standalone.
It's a performance. Time.
My introduction to the song was I remember Elvis Costello being very fond of it and thrashing it out with the Attractions a lot in the 1980s.
I've heard his version of that.
Which is great. So they're the first batch of songs there. I meant to mention there that Mr. Moonlight was written by Roy Lee Johnson. And in the grand year of 2020, Roy Lee Johnson is still alive at the age of 81.
Really?
Yes. He
and living off the royalties.
Living off the royalties. He made his money. He was quite young when he wrote Mr. Moonlight. He was a teenager and it was in his high school band. And it got released as a B-side of the group he was in, which was Dr. Feelgood, not
Dr.
that
Feelgood,
one.
Yeah.
And he stayed in the music business for 20 years or so, putting out records, but he seems to have kind of pulled back a little bit, and he's obviously making a tidy sum every year from Beatle royalties. 81 years old, Roy Lee Johnson.
It's the dream, right? One song gets the Beatles to record it. And
It's the Roy Wood story, isn't it?
It's a Hollywood story. Yes.
Write a song, live in a nice house.
Roll on Christmas.
So then, you know, what's interesting about Beatles for Sale is they record the album in 8 days, but obviously it's not 8 days in a row. It's 8 days spread in between August and October.
I thought you were going for the 8 days in a week.
Oh, darn it. Yeah. 8 days a year. 8 days, 8 days between a tour. Between August and October, they find 8 days to try and put the album together. So, you know, it's hard to think in our modern, you know, album tour cycle, you know, and promo cycle that, you know, you'd start an album and then hook off on a US tour. But that's what the Beatles do, that they start their US tour on the 19th of August. And this is the tour that gives us the first batch of recordings for the Hollywood Bowl. But there's the other big seismic thing that happens on this tour, which is...
They meet Bob Dylan.
Now, you know, Beatle fans everywhere know that this is, you know, one of these events that supposedly changed rock history.
changed everyone. It changed the Beatles. It changed Bob Dylan. It changed the world. It changed you and it changed me.
Well, yeah, it certainly, probably.
Or Or did it? That's the...
It certainly was a good day out, I suppose.
It was a good night in. Yeah, this is one of those sort of legendary summits. You know, the Beatles really, I think, George had picked up on freewheeling.
Yeah.
Lennon mentions in an interview, you know, that they spent that entire time that they were in Paris at the start of the year, they were just listening to that record nonstop. And my favorite quote from him is, for 3 weeks in Paris, we didn't stop playing it. We all went potty about Dylan. You see what he did there? So it was, you know, they knew they were going to meet him. They
were all a bit nervous, though, weren't they? I mean, that was the thing. They were kind of sizing each other out.
I think this is the thing. They were all five of them were sort of aware of the significance of this and the significance of each other. And they got a middleman, Al Aronovitz, a journalist, to broker this. Dylan turns up at the hotel.
Yeah.
They smoke some dope, drink some cheap wine.
And Epstein is enjoying and partaking as well, and they're all having a great time. Now, there's the, you know, between Mark Lewisohn's kind of biography and also the Riding So High book that came out last year, there's some debate as to whether this was the introduction to pot or not that the Beatles
experienced. Yes, again, there are interviews with George later on saying, you know, Dylan introduced us to pot, et cetera, et cetera. But George in Anthology says they tried cannabis in Liverpool after they had been to Hamburg.
Yeah.
So he sort of contradicts himself slightly there. And there's an interview with John Lennon, 1975, where he says, you know, they were smoking marijuana in 1960 with this chap, Royston Ellis.
Yes.
So I think I'm not sure whether we mentioned Royston Ellis in a previous episode.
I'm losing track. we might have. But he was a kind of an English-based beat poet, kind of alternative lifestyle, S&M merchant.
Wasn't he into crazy sexual
He is. Exploits?
I think that this is true, because he, if we go on to Abbey Road and Polythene Pam.
Yes,
and
he was involved in
possibly
that.
He was involved in an incident back in around this time. So he's an English beat poet. He met George first. He was there. Ellis was up in Liverpool to do a reading at the university. He's hanging out at the Jacaranda. He was 19. He sees George, 17.
Yes.
And it was quite openly, you know, he thought George is a good looking boy. Tried to pick him up, I think. George takes him back to Gambier Terrace, where Lennon's living with Sutcliffe. And suddenly you have this meeting of the sort of art school types with this beat poet. And it flows from there. Yeah. Lennon talks about Ellis frequently.
He doesn't forget about him.
He doesn't forget him. He introduced them to breaking open in asthma inhalers to get the drugs out of that.
Yeah.
The Lewisohn, I think, says he got them their first mention in a music paper.
Yes.
So he's back to London, does an interview and says, I'm going to get the Beatles down from Liverpool. They're the only group that know what I'm
all about.
Where I'm coming from, what I'm all about.
So the US tour ends on the 20th of September at the Paramount Theatre in New York City. And just over a week later, they're back in Abbey Road. And this time, Paul has finally managed to get his pencil out and he's written Every Little Thing, which is, you could argue, maybe that was aiming for single material. That's a great song.
It is a great song. It is a really good song. Listening to it, it's a song that could have been written, you know, if this turned up on a new Paul McCartney album for the first time, it wouldn't sound out of place. I think there is a sort of timeless quality to this. I don't know what it is that particularly draws me to this song, but I really do like this song. And I think, I'd like to see him put it in his set list.
Yeah, I like kind of the song is, you know, he's trying to bring in a bit of drama. The thing I think listening to it is, you know, are they trying to get like a Phil Spector thing going on, you know, with kind of the timpani and the boom, and you know, did it need a bit more Vavavoom, you know, is that something he was trying to reach for? Because you can sense there are certain bits on Beatles for Sale where you can start to see them trying to broaden their horizon, experiment with sounds and instruments, do one or two different things. It's not quite as regressive as the album's Reputation. You know, there are a couple of little moments where they're trying to be a little bit clever, even though they're working so darn fast.
This is, you know, I wonder, is Paul conscious here that Lennon is dominating this album? He's got to up his game. So when he does bring in a song, you know, it's got to be a good song. And, you know, this is a song that's full of little hooks. It's got the timpani. It's got little kind of things that catch your ear. So there is a lot going on. And yes, it was again, it was being touted as a possible single. You know, we know that competition exists.
Absolutely.
To get the A side. Yeah. So that's,
And then the next thing they record is I Don't Want to Spoil the Party. And I think this is a song, I think generally this is, you could argue it's not a very well-known Beatles song, certainly by the general public. But it is a little gem, isn't it?
It is. And it's probably the most country and Western.
Yeah.
Sounding thing that they do. And
there's a couple of country and Western sounds that happen on the album. Like we'll talk about Carl Perkins songs and that in a second.
Yeah.
You know, it is a bag that they dip into now and then, and Ringo later on with Act Naturally, and you know, you could argue Don't Pass Me By has got elements of a country song. It's not.
It is alien. I mean, again, it's an element, it's a reflection of sort of things that they would have been listening to as kids, I suppose.
Yeah.
You know, again, one of the things that sets them apart from other bands is of their generation is they are listening to show tunes. They are listening to country and Western. They're sort of soaking all of this up.
There's kind of an Everly Brothers vibe coming off. I Don't Want to Spoil the Party, you know?
There is. And the interesting thing to me is that it's primarily sung by John and George.
Right.
With Paul sort of doing the harmonies. But, you know, people talk about, you know, how well John and Paul's voices blend, but actually in this case George is taking a more prominent role.
Yes. And Paul does, or sorry, George does a lovely Carl Perkins style solo on that.
His Gretsch Country Gentleman guitar,
which falls off the roof in December 65 on tour, gets smashed.
Is
so
this
sad.
Your banjo? Yeah.
And as if they hadn't done enough work for one day on the 29th of September, they start work on What You're Doing. But that's a first pass, and that's a song that kind of gets benched and redone later on.
Yes, they seem to have real trouble with this. Yeah. So they finally, after seven takes, they sort of nail a rhythm track. But you know, again, they come back. It this gives them a lot of trouble.
Next day, 30th of September, second day in a row, they put the timpani drums on Every Little Thing. They have a bit of a laugh. They try and do What You're Doing again, and that gets parked. But then they go in for, you know, probably the song that nobody dislikes, which is No Reply, which ends up being the opening track of the album. And as we said, that kind of had begun as a rough demo, so that had been floating around. So they had a rough idea of how they wanted to approach it, but it's still a, you know, when you actually listen to it, it is meticulously kind of put together.
It is, and the arrangement, I think, on the demo broadly survives through. So as you say, they had a pretty good idea of what they were gonna do with it.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of bootlegs around at this session, and
there
this
is
a session where
don't
slow down, for Christ's sake, or I'll give you no more drugs.
That's right.
That you think, okay, that's John exhort, you know, keep going if you want your drug supply. And you think, but it seems odd that would be so openly.
It is. That's also the one where they say,
I'll let you say.
Well,
this.
I won't say it. I'll say the abridged version. Been to the toilet, Megan. It's that one, isn't it? That's the same.
If anybody knows who or what
Megan, it sounds very goonish when they say that, so I wonder if it's some reference to something we don't know.
The reference to Megan turns up again in one of the Christmas single. They're sort of talking about what they're doing, and you can hear one of the, I think it's John is speaking or George is speaking, and somebody in the background is talking about Megan or Megan this or so. Yeah, there's obviously somebody there, but
and it's No Reply, you know, it's you know, George Martin used to have this notion that the albums should start with an exciting potboiler. And it's not a potboiler to start the album with. It's very, it's got a very spaced sound. There's no electric guitar on it, which is the first Lennon song with no electric guitar. There's an awful lot of space, as I said, in the mix. And it's thrilling, you know, that kind of, what was it, Revolution in the Head says that, you know, that middle section is probably their most exciting 30 seconds. There is that kind of thrilling drama to it. But it's not propulsive like "And I Saw Her Standing There" or "And a Hard Day's Night," you know.
No, and it's not. You couldn't say it was a sort of an upbeat or joyous song. I mean, it's sort of, you know, despairing, lost love sort of thing. So the subject matter is not uplifting. And again, there's a little tiny a cappella section at the beginning. So the first thing that hits you on this album is John's voice.
Yeah,
and that trick of doing that is repeated a couple of times on the album. So you've got that absolutely sort of, and in the remastered versions, you that just leaps out of the speakers.
It does actually
that voice.
So a couple of days later, 6th of October, they're back in and they spend that day working on 8 days a Week, which is I have a love-hate relationship with 8 days a Week. I sometimes think, first of all, when it turns up on the one compilation, I feel no. because
it's not a single in the
UK. It's not a single in the UK. And it's,
should it have been a single in the UK?
I don't know. I sometimes feel 8 days a Week is a bit too cutie-cutie. You know, it feels a bit...
Really? But you're Mr. Pop.
I know.
You like the cutie-cutie.
I know. I just never... listen... It's still a great song by the Beatles. I'm maybe being slightly contrarian, but I wouldn't think it's like one of their all-time classics.
Oh, you see, I absolutely on the other side of that. I think this is just everything that is brilliant about the Beatles in the first phase of their career is in this song. Whether it's the arrangement, it's the voices, it's the hand claps. Did you went to see the was it 2 years ago? Jeff Emmerich promoted a sort of a stage show that was a mock-up of Studio 2. I thought that was absolutely fantastic. For people that didn't see it, I can't remember the name of the
touring, but it was a very odd thing, but it was
contrived that you were sort of looking down into Studio 2 and you had two or three Beatles tribute bands playing the parts of the Beatles, but the section where they were putting this together and doing the intro and doing the hand claps, and that was I love this song.
Okay, well done.
I can't believe I think we may have reached a line in the sand.
But here. isn't that why you know you can talk about the Beatles forever? With 8 days a Week, this is an early example of them kind of experimenting in the studio. They don't necessarily come in with it all ready to go, particularly the fade in and all that kind of stuff. It's all experimental slightly.
It is. So this is really the first time that the song is unfinished. So they're sort of working it up. So normally this is something they would have done, you know, round at Paul's house or John Wimpole Street or at John's house or whatever. So the fade in and all of those things are being added at different stages, and they're playing around with the arrangement. So it's the session tapes for this are really interesting because you can hear them trying things out and discarding things and bringing things in. And you can hear John playing a little riff in the background from I Feel Fine.
So that's so obviously on the horizon.
That's on the horizon coming as well.
And it's the song that opens side two on the album. So you get this fade into side two on the album, which is a very different way than side one opens. I sometimes wonder, you know, you could argue that you could almost flip the sides of Beatles for Sale, make the B side the A side and the A side the B side.
I actually think that might improve its reputation.
You know, you might want to still nudge Honey Dome somewhere else, but if it opened with 8 days a Week and ended with Kansas City, hey, that would be a good run.
That would be a good run. I think we maybe come on to it, but I think this album, it does not end well.
Ooh, that sounds ominous. Oh my God. So 2 days later, another recording session, one more song, She's a Woman. Now, obviously, this isn't for the album, because apart from the 14 songs for the album, they need 2 songs for a single. Why? Because they're the Beatles, and that's just the way things are done. And so the 8th of October, they put down She's a Woman, written and recorded in 1 day. Apparently, Paul brings it in, still hot off the griddle.
He just, between leaving his house and getting to the studio, he wrote it in his head. What a guy.
What a guy.
Take that instant karma.
So it's a very unique song. He's got a very specific vocal style on it, which is, you know, you don't really get him singing that way a lot, you know.
This is a song that I've always had a bit of a problem with. This idea of maybe trying to write a song with one chord or two chords, and I just kind of feel it doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't do anything. It starts off quite kind of interesting, that kind of emphasis on the offbeat, but it just keeps going.
But let's give a shout out to Ringo, because there's a song, as you say, the guitar is playing on the offbeat, and Ringo finds the space to actually drop in as that offbeat is being hit on the guitar. You know, it's almost like a reggae offbeat.
It is. It's very strange. Yeah.
And then Ringo tumbles in, finds the space to play that serves the song. You know, Paul sings this kind of, you know, very kind of high, soulful kind of voice that he's bringing to that. And he's, it gets into the live set, She's a Woman.
And you would think this would be a very difficult song to play live.
Yeah.
To replicate, particularly with Lennon on rhythm guitar. I mean, he's kind of notoriously wayward with time. And, you know, like when he's writing songs, he doesn't pay much attention to the you know, 4 bars, or he could have 7 bars, or switch into something else. But it's sort of, in terms of the middle 8, in terms of it just seems very static.
And it does have that line though, turn me on when I get lonely. It's got it's a bit fruity.
Well, this is supposed to be a drug reference,
right?
So this isn't a kind of a sexual reference. Again, we keep referring back to Riding So High by Joe Gooden, which is an excellent
book.
And he said this phrase, you know, turn me on, or I'll turn you on, doesn't take on a sexual meaning until much later in the 60s, where it becomes a bit of a cliche. But at this stage, it's a drug reference. You turn on by taking
and
drugs.
It is interesting that, we have these first set of sessions, they meet Dylan, and then they have the second set of sessions, and there's just subtle changes happening, you know?
And that it's coming from Paul.
Yes.
Who is always sort of the last to experiment, or the last to take the drugs, the last to, you know. But so this is, again, that's an interesting aspect of the song, but the whole peasant present.
Yeah, okay. It's not your favourite moment.
It's not my favourite moment.
They then kick off their 5th UK tour on the 9th of October, and this is the tour where they hit Belfast and Dublin, 2 great places.
Yes, and I'm going to get Belfast twice. Belfast twice.
Well, they play Belfast the following year. Don't they? 65. They play Belfast twice on that tour.
On this tour.
And just looking at the set list, Twist and Shout, Money, Can't Buy Me Love, Things We Said Today, I'm Happy Just to Dance With You, I Should Have Known Better, that's nice, If I Fell, I Want to Be Your Man, Hard Day's Night, and Long Tall Sally. That's kind of a standard set list. That's what they played in Belfast.
Yeah. You would be much happier. I think I would be much, much happier to have that set list than any set list to date.
Yeah, it's pretty. It's nice to see, you know, you don't kind of think of I Should Have Known Better as being in their live set.
No. And you think these are Hard Day's Night songs are suddenly front and center.
And it's interesting how they kind of slip away over the next 2 years of playing live and they still keep doing, you know, Long Tall Sally and some of the straight, you know, the more straightforward rock and roll covers. Like the rock and roll covers stay there till the end, which is a curious thing. So what they're now doing, now that they're on tour, is they're trying to squeeze in album sessions on rare days off. So they'll be at some end of the country and they'll be barreling back down to Abbey Road. So the next day they get free is the 18th of October, and they go into Abbey Road and they do an outro piece for 8 Days a Week. And then they hit into Kansas City, Hey, 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 which is great.
It's a great, just straight ahead Paul doing what he does best.
And then they go into Mr. Moonlight, and they do kind of another kind of take through on Mr. Moonlight.
Too good to leave alone. You know, too good not to do it twice.
It is interesting that, you know, they're putting Leave My Kitten Alone. They've kind of forgotten. You wonder, are they just moving so fast that
they're losing track of what they have?
Well, what is the? I mean, you kind of think of bands today. I remember reading a thing. You know, when Radiohead were putting together OK Computer, which is in 1997, they had copious amounts of mini discs because that was the technology at the time.
Yeah.
They were trying to resequence the album on mini disc, and they were kind of going crazy trying to figure out, you know, they were demoing on mini disc, and mini disc was the thing. When the Beatles do a day in Abbey Road and then they're playing gigs for a week, they don't really have a context to listen back to the music. They don't have a personal stereo to stick it on, or, you know, they might have acetates and a portable record player at best.
Yeah, but I mean, you were saying about one day. I mean, they're on the 16th of October, they're in Hull.
Yeah.
18th of October, they're in Abbey Road. The 19th, they're in Edinburgh. So they have to sort of barrel back up the road. I mean, that's insane. It's the other end of the country, you know. So yes, you do have the sense that they go in, they record these. They leave it with the engineers. They leave it with George Martin to sort of do mixes and they're just off thinking about the next gig.
What's odd about when you look at these sessions is they're kind of doing, you know, rough and ready songs that they're kind of thrown at the wall. They're doing stuff like, you know, as we said, you know, the aforementioned Mr. Moonlight, and then they go straight from trying to remake Mr. Moonlight into doing I Feel Fine.
I Feel Fine.
How sublime is I Feel Fine?
Like it's
fantastic. I don't know about you, but to me, it, you know, we kind of lose the context now many years later, but it's hard to believe that I Feel Fine is cut from the same cloth as the rest of Beatles for Sale.
It doesn't sound the same.
No.
It's you know, it sounds, you can hear this sound moving towards what we get on not even sort of Ticket to Ride, but you know, Day Tripper and Rubber Soul. You can hear the sound. They're sort of reaching for that, I think, with this song.
Yeah, and it's like I Feel Fine eventually wins to become a single, and I guess it's recorded knowing it's going to be the single.
Yes, I think you know, we've had I'm a Loser, we've had it's other, you know, Every Little Thing, but this I think is clearly head and shoulders above. So you would have to imagine that when this is presented, everyone is thinking, right, this is the single. This has to be the single.
And an interesting fact, Stephen, did you know that Paul invented feedback for this single, and that subsequently invented everything Jimi Hendrix did?
That's one of my favorite parts of Anthology is when they're all sitting around, I think in Friar Park, and in the studio, and they're talking about this, about inventing, John leaning his guitar up and blah, blah, blah. And Paul goes, yeah. And this, we did it before. And, you know, Jimi Hendrix, I'm doing Paul impressions now. you know, he's actually clearing, and you can just see George and Ringo
laughing. Just having a laugh at him. But it's
having a laugh.
But again, you pick apart the bits of I Feel Fine, you know, so the feedback, which is a very intentional kind of recorded moment at the start of the song.
Yes.
You know, the riff kind of has a tightness and a clarity to it. Again, Ringo comes in right, picks the right space to just sort of tumble into the song. And he's doing these incredible ride cymbal fills.
His drumming on this is incredible.
Yeah.
It's a kind of slightly Latin feel. His drumming is superb on this.
Yeah, you can go off to YouTube and listen to just the drums from I Feel Fine. They're embarrassingly, you know, when you think about how compact Ringo's kit is. I'm not a drummer per se, but he's basically got a very straightforward kit.
Yeah.
And you kind of listen to the drums on their own from I Feel Fine. It's ridiculous. He makes it look so easy. But you're right. I Feel Fine sort of does have this feeling. I think I'm a Loser has it too. You kind of think, well, what songs here could have appeared on the Help album or maybe Rubber Soul? And I think I Feel Fine, I'm a Loser maybe could have gone over there, whereas something like Kansas City, you think, could have been on with the Beatles. You know, it's interesting to see which album, which songs get pulled one way and which songs get pulled another way. But I Feel Fine is getting earmarked for a single. And that's only, recorded on the 18th of October, they are cutting it fine in order to try and get this out for Christmas.
They just seem to do this time around this period, this kind of 63, 64, 65, they're constantly just pushing against deadline.
Yes, yes. So next up, this is a busy day. They do I Follow the Sun, which is a very old song from Paul. So yeah. Again, Paul, not really present. He's pulling out a song that is, you know, Cavern Club pre-fame type song,
yeah,
really.
Yeah, yeah. Pete Best talks about Paul playing this in Germany in the Kaiserkeller on the piano.
Yeah.
It's a very pretty song.
Yeah.
It's very straightforward. And I never really thought too much about the lyric to this song. But mm-hmm. actually, when I was researching this, it was saying, well, the singer here is leaving.
Yeah.
One day you'll know I was the one.
Yeah.
And they're saying, you know, it's very Paul. It's, you know, you didn't know you had a good thing here. And
don't underestimate Paul.
One day you'll be sorry. But it's an odd lyric to be dressed up. You know, at first listen, I think you just think this is a very straightforward.
But it is one of those songs that he has come back to it. It's on his Amoeba gig live album, and he plays it there.
Yeah, but it's a kind of perfect Paul song. It's a little kind of simple, straightforward. It's like a melody that you imagine must always have existed.
Yeah,
but it didn't. It just he kind of plucked it out of the air. But it's very, very sweet song, and I don't think it is overly sweet. Sometimes Paul's ballads can be a little bit sweet, a little bit sickly sweet, but I think this is a lovely song.
It is nice that it is short, you know, that it doesn't outstay its welcome. It's a great song. And then next up to the mic is Mr. George Harrison, who records Everybody's Trying to Be My Baby.
Yes.
Which is a Carl Perkins song, the first of two Carl Perkins songs that makes the album. And, you know, the Beatles loved Carl Perkins. George in particular.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, George's rockabilly credentials are pretty well established. This is a very odd song again, in that, you know, I quite like the song, but it's the song that they used to finish the album. And there's just in that position, I think it's not satisfactory. You may have noticed over the years, I'm quite fond of George, and I have noticed from time to time. But I think this is where you're coming back to your point about if we flipped, the two sides. I think this would be better to close side one rather than, you know, it can't compete with Twist and Shout or Money, or, you know, it's not in the same.
And it has a very retro sound to it, this kind of slap back Elvis-y sound, you know?
Yes. So there's a lot of tape echo.
Yeah.
And particularly on the vocal.
Yeah.
But the guitar part is leaking into the vocal mic, so then the guitar picks up this tape echo as well.
Yes.
Supposedly this is done in one take. Although Ian McDonald says, you know, well, you can hear a tambourine overdubbed, and that must be Lennon.
Yeah.
But this is Jeff Emmerich, who does not have much time for George, praises this as being one of his better performances. But I think that's maybe indicative of just he's got to do right by Carl Perkins.
Yeah. And it's George's moment on the album. It's unusual that he closes out the album, which isn't his normal position.
No, I think it's the only time he gets to do that. And I have to say I don't think it works. It doesn't work as a closer. I think it's a mid-album track. It's not a closer track.
And it's interesting that, you know, we can't underestimate the importance of Carl Perkins to the Beatles. He's in their lives for years afterwards.
Yes, yes. So this is, you know, George, whenever they were touring with Johnny Gentle in May 1960, and they all adopted, you know, Paul Ramone, and you know, he was Carl Harrison, so
yeah,
he's paying homage to him. This rockabilly style. He and Ringo are particularly enamored of that sort of country and western rockabilly song. I think I have a note here. They played 11 Carl Perkins songs.
All right,
their live show. So lots of that they didn't record, but Tennessee Blue Suede Shoes, Lend Me Your Comb, Glad All Over, Matchbox, Everybody's Trying to Be My Baby, Honey Don't. You know, so he was a big influence.
Yeah.
And there's been some speculation over the years as to whether Carl Perkins was actually present when this song was being recorded. Carl seemed to think he was present.
Yep.
Everybody else seems to think, no, he wasn't really present. And that it's all of this speculation is based largely on Carl's memory, but he seems to be referring to a session that took place in June 1964, which is around the time that Ringo, just before Ringo fell ill and Jimmy Nicol enters the picture. So he was definitely in the studio for that session. And I think he's just confusing the two sessions.
And it's a very busy session because we're still on the 18th of October and they're still not finished. The next thing, like George is obviously able to knock out Everybody's Trying to Be My Baby because it's been in their live set forever. And then the next thing they knock out is John steps forward to do Rock and Roll Music.
Yeah.
And that gets put down pretty quickly.
Again, this is a, you know, supposedly a single take with George Martin on piano.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe not. No one
or maybe maybe two or three people playing the piano.
People. And, Derek Taylor on the sleeve notes refers to it as being George Martin, Paul and John.
Yeah.
All crowded around one piano. Mark Lewison says, no, single take George Martin on piano. According to Jeff Emmerich, Paul played the piano and George Harrison was playing bass. the piano is excellent. And you've got to kind of think, is it more, who was the better rock and roll piano player, George Martin or Paul McCartney? Your money would be on Paul. I think.
And then it's actually Chuck Berry's birthday. It's recorded on his 38th birthday.
38th birthday. He was 38.
So old.
So old.
I like Rock and Roll Music. I think it's a good cover. It stays in the live set as well. And then they record another. So we've had, it's interesting. We have George, who records a Carl Perkins song. We've got John, who records a Chuck Berry song. And then next up to the mic, we have Paul McCartney recording a Buddy Holly song.
Yeah.
And so they record Words of Love. And it's the only Buddy Holly song that the Beatles recorded. And considering, you know, how much he gave to the band, it's a wonder that there isn't more Beatle Buddy Holly. I suppose we've got That'll Be the Day on the anthology as well.
Yeah, yeah. This is interesting because who's singing it?
Well, I've always thought it's just John and Paul, a close John and Paul.
Yeah, but Revolution in the Head says no, it's George, it's John and George. This is going to be like a who did the as in A Day in the Life.
Well,
we're going to have to get people to.
Yes, we've had that vote, and that was people were pulling each other apart. But that's all on one day. I mean, that's an extraordinary day's work where they record 8 days a week: Kansas City, Mr. Moonlight, I Feel Fine, I Follow the Sun, Everybody's Trying to Be My Baby, Rock and Roll Music, and Words of Love. One day's work. And then they are back on the road again. They go up to Edinburgh, Dundee, and back in London, they're kind of mixing and starting to put the album together.
The glamour of the road,
But there is still some recording because the album is not finished and there's one day of recording left, which is the 26th of October. And, Ringo hasn't had a song all year. He hasn't had any song in 1964. No. And everybody loves a bit of Ringo. So
everybody loves a Ringo song.
So Carl Perkins gets another royalty check as Ringo records Honey Don't. Again, another song that they're able to probably do in their sleep at this point.
Yes, although the fascinating point here is that John usually sings this song.
Okay.
So they did it on the BBC sessions. You can hear John singing it, but here, I'm guessing it suits Ringo's range. Is that the?
Yeah, I suppose that's a nice way of putting it.
Well, he had recorded, Ringo actually had recorded Matchbox in June of this year for a standalone EP.
Yes.
So he did have a song.
Yes. Okay, fair enough.
But not an album or a single. It was that, so again, this is his second Carl Perkins cover of the year. So, you know, Carl's getting the royalty checks. Well, I'm hoping that Carl was getting the royalty checks.
I like Honey Don't because I like a Ringo moment on an album. It always cheers me up. And I just think it maybe goes on for one lap too long, you know?
It's just a little bit.
It's like, another solo? Oh, okay.
Yes.
I see.
A little bit too long, and this is the, you know, rock on, George, for Ringo one time.
Here's the thing, though, and you might think this is very spurious. I think this is the first Beatles song to mention another Beatles song.
Okay.
Because in the middle of it, Ringo says, "I feel fine."
Very good.
Yes. Yeah. No. Is that a pub quiz?
Well, I think that's a good. Write that down.
So,
well, Ringo obviously likes this song.
Well, he sang it at the concert for George.
He sang it at the concert for George. Have I ever mentioned that?
Were you at the concert?
I was at that. I'm surprised that I haven't mentioned that.
You should have told me that before.
We'll talk about that sometime. So he still puts this in his live set.
Mm-hmm.
And he recorded a duet with Carl Perkins in 1996.
Now, that's an album. Do you have that album?
I have this album.
Of course you do.
Of course I do.
But I didn't know it's got all the Beatles on it.
Yes.
And it's from 1996.
It's from 1996. And you're thinking this is going to be like a Free as a Bird style resurrecting John Lennon. But this is a sort of Carl Perkins tribute album almost to himself. But he's sort of duetting with lots of other people. But you have George sings a song, Ringo does Honey Don't,
mm-hmm.
Paul gets a song, and John, they use Blue Suede Shoes from Live Peace in Toronto.
Oh, right. That's interesting.
But you've also got Jimi Hendrix. There's a Jimi Hendrix live track that they pull on as well.
Yeah.
Plus, you've got Tom Petty, John Fogerty,
yeah.
and Willie Nelson, and that other guy from Ireland.
Ah,
Bono.
So,
but that's no reason not to buy the album.
What a great record that must be. Bono.
Yeah.
We love it. Yeah. Let's not turn this into the U2. Yes. I'm pro U2, pro Bono. Not pro Bono like a
pro Bono as in your, yeah.
Well, I am doing this for free.
You're doing this for free.
But and you don't like U2, and that's maybe where we'll leave it.
I like a little bit of U2.
Okay.
In the middle of their career. I like the Berlin stuff.
Okay. Yes, you have to love Achtung Baby. I reckon when all this is over, we're going to get an Achtung Baby revival tour. You've learned it here on a Beatles podcast for some reason. Then there's one last bit of recording to be done, and it's a remake of What You're Doing. So again,
yes.
Paul, a little bit kind of not really having any standout moments. He kind of does What You're Doing, and it's another kind of song that, a bit like Every Little Thing, you think kind of has a Spectre-ish vibe going on, you know?
Yes. It's there's a lot going on in this song. And again, you sort of maybe have the sense of Paul knowing that he doesn't have a lot of songs on this album, so he's really got to pull out all the stops. So he supposedly guides Ringo, you know, tells Ringo how to play the drums, basically, and is basing this on Be My Baby, which is a Spectre. You've got a drum intro.
Yep. Unusual
intro section. There's like a breakdown in the middle of it, so the drums fade out, and then there's a little bass solo comes in to bring back.
Yeah,
and
the end is great.
It's great, and that's quite a modern idea to do that.
But it's also that notion of Paul, and I know we've said this before, that, you know, he doesn't just write songs, he kind of thinks in records, you know. He's starting to now get this notion of, you're starting to see Paul as someone who's not just writing the song, but he's arranging it, he's putting the idea of how it should be as a whole, you know.
Yes.
And that kind of evolves into, you know, Penny Lane Paul, for instance, you know.
Yes. He's got not only the arrangement, he's got the actual sound. You imagine he can actually hear these songs in his head. Again, we're saying this is a Paul song, but Paul in many years from now is saying, no, this was a 50-50
co-write.
You know,
yeah.
Co-write, yeah.
It's interesting. And
this is another song that I think if it was on the new Paul McCartney album, it would fit right in.
There's a new Paul McCartney album. That'd be great.
Well, we're only ever 9 or 10 years away from a new Paul McCartney album.
And the last bit of recording they do is the Christmas Fan Club disc, which we've talked about on our Christmas episode. And then they're back out on the road again.
They sound so tired.
Yeah.
On this Christmas record. This is the disc on which Paul says, you know, I don't know where we'd be without you. And John in the background goes, in the army, probably. You know, so you get the sense that he probably at this stage might rather be in the army.
Well, what we have then is they're back out on the road. The album doesn't come out until the very start of December. The tour goes on until November, and they're introducing songs from the album on the tour. So the Christmas, we've talked about their set lists in 1964. They've now evolved into opening with Twist and Shout, I'm a Loser, Babies in Black, Everyone's Trying to Be My Baby, Can't Buy Me Love, Honey Don't, I Feel Fine, She's a Woman, Hard Day's Night, Rock and Roll Music. That's the Christmas show set list that they debut in December after the album comes out. So while they're finishing their UK tour, the album is, you know, being compiled, mixed, put together, and it's rushed out on the same day as the I Feel Fine single at the start of December 64. Then in the US, though, that doesn't happen. As we said at the start, that's possibly one of the things that is against this album standing, is that a generation grew up without Beatles for Sale. Instead, in the US in December 64, they put out the album, which is called Beatles 65.
Yes.
And the first side of Beatles 65 is very like it's the first six songs from Beatles for Sale, essentially. No Reply, I'm a Loser, Babes in Black, Rock and Roll Music, I'll Follow Son of Mr. Moonlight. And then flipping the side over, 8 Days a Week is not on the album. That's saved for a 65 single. And it's Honey Don't, I'll Be Back, She's a Woman, I Feel Fine, though, is on Beatles 65. And then it ends with Everybody's Trying to Be My Baby. So, you know, we're going to talk about the 14-track UK Beatles for Sale album. And as I said, coming back to it for this, I am, I've really grown back into loving this record. I think there is a ton of great stuff on it, and actually its reputation is totally undeserved.
I think I agree with you.
Yeah.
Going into this, when you said, you know, let's do an episode on Beatles for Sale, I thought this is going to be a chore. You know, this is not an album. There's a lot here to talk about. You know, the B-side of this album, apart from 8 Days a Week, these songs, it was almost as if I was hearing them for the first time. You know, Every Little Thing, What You're Doing, those aren't songs that were really on my radar at all.
Yeah, certainly the song I've been listening to over and over is I Don't Want to Spoil the Party. That probably that would have been 6 weeks ago. I would have given that the accolade of my least listened to Beatles song,
yes,
you know?
Yes.
And Beatles for Sale is probably the one Beatles album where if you asked me, name the track listing from start to finish, I'd be thinking, I'd be like, oh, wait a sec, hold on. I'm not sure where's Every Little Thing. Now I think it's great. I've obviously, as is my wont, I have a couple of theories about this. I think...
Here we go. Buckle up. Yeah.
Beatles for Sale has this notion of it's their tired album. It's their end of a busy year album. I think Beatles for Sale is their first pass, unknowingly perhaps, but it's their first pass at doing Get Back. And when I say that, if you look at the way the songs hang about, they are... Some of it is celebrating their live bandness, but the covers that are on this are the people who are the direct antecedents to the Beatles. So, you know, you've got Buddy Holly, Chuck Berry, Little Richard, Carl Perkins. These are all represented in the cover versions. They're not going for esoteric cover versions from people you haven't heard of, except maybe Mr. Moonlight.
Yeah.
And so it's like a Get Back project where they're saying, you know, this is our live set. This is what we're cut from. And these new songs are where we're going. And so it kind of, if you kind of think of it that way, and you see it in, like, you know, the bits of the production where they're trying to mimic Spectre that we've mentioned, that slapback sound on George Harrison's Everybody's Trying to Be My Baby. That's very retro. That's like the Elvis Presley nod on the album, maybe. So from an album that comes out in 64, there's lots of it that kind of looks back at the previous 8 or 10 years and says these are the ingredients of what make us, and so it's like a Get Back project. Yes, no, maybe.
Okay, well, I take your point.
to keep our U2 analogy up, maybe it's their Rattle and Hum, you know, where they're showing their influences on their sleeve, particularly their American influences, but maybe it's not the best.
We don't want to labor the U2 analogy. I certainly don't want to labor the U2 analogy. I hear what you're saying, but I mean,
I hear what you're saying is meeting speak for I don't agree with you.
Yeah, I don't agree with you. Well, the reason why, I mean, Get Back comes out of a situation where they're not playing live. They're trying to rediscover that sort of spark. Mm-hmm. It's almost the opposite. They're just weighed down with touring commitments, where they're in Abbey Road on one day, they're then driving getting back up to Edinburgh the next day. They're, you know, they can't get off that live.
There certainly isn't a big picture notion with them yet of this is an album and we need to, you know, tie up the title, the picture, the songs, the originals. You know, there's 8 originals on the album, 5 John, 3 Paul, you know, and it's you know, it's still...
One of the very first things that we talked about on this podcast was Help.
Yes.
And we talked about Help being a sort of, I think we came to the conclusion it was a sort of transition album. You've got that sort of Dizzy Miss Lizzy cover. You've got this sort of grasping at something with the likes of Ticket to Ride. There's a modern sound. There's shifting sound. And I was very sort of locked into this idea that Help is that transition album.
Yeah.
But I actually think my theory would be that you need to take Beatles for Sale and Help together.
Yeah.
And they're actually much, much more similar than I had thought. That, you know, you've got something like I Feel Fine, which we've said is a really modern sounding track. It's different from what's happening elsewhere on Beatles for Sale, but what you're doing is also different from what's happening because you've got that Spectre thing. You've got a studio sound. You've things like No Reply, I'm a Loser. The original songs here, not I'll Follow the Sun, which is just a throwback, but the songs which are being written in 1964 for this album are reaching forward past Help to Rubber Soul. And I think if you treat Beatles for Sale and Help as a block.
But do you know what is striking, though, is that, you know, Beatles for Sale and I Feel Fine come out at the start of December 64. And the next time a consumer drops a needle on a new Beatles record, the sound that they get is Ticket to Ride.
Yeah.
And that is a game changer in a way.
Yes.
And if you actually look at the recording order, you know, we said there that their last day of recording is the 26th of October, 64. They put down Honey Don't and What You're Doing. The next time they go into a recording studio on February the 15th, it's Ticket to Ride is the first thing they lay down as well. And they do a week in February 65 and it's Ticket to Ride, Another Girl, I Need You. Yes, it is. The Night Before, You Like Me Too Much, If You've Got Trouble, Tell Me What You See, You're Going to Lose a Girl, That Means a Lot, You've Got to Hide Your Love Away. All that stuff comes out in a week in February.
Mm.
That's quite a jump in 2 months.
It is, but What You're Doing is
like the song. What you're doing.
But do you not think What You're Doing fits into what they will be doing in 2 months?
I think they do. I think you're right. I think What You're Doing, I'm a Loser. And
stop
I feel
there.
Fine.
Just stop.
You're right, Stephen.
You're right. That's it. Just stop there.
But I know. Yes, you're right.
You know, if we leave Honey Don't to one side.
Yeah.
On the basis that's we've got to get a song for Ringo.
Yeah.
And we, you know, Rockabilly, we'll give him that. The song that they're working on there, What You're Doing, is a very sophisticated arrangement.
Yeah, sophistication is appearing on Beatles for Sale.
And that's really, I suppose, you're saying it better than I said it. It's, but with 8 days a week, What You're Doing, I Feel Fine, there's a degree of sophistication coming in that really prefigures Help and Ticket to Ride and those songs. But and on Help, they haven't quite shaken off the cover. You know, they haven't quite got rid of the Act Naturally and Dizzy Miss Lizzy. And, you know, so I think this sort of bleeds into it. The very best songs, and I would count Paul's What You're Doing, just in terms of the sophistication of the arrangement and the just everything about that song is amazing. But yet, it's not a song I'm particularly familiar with because it's just stuck at the back of this album you're told not to like.
Yeah, and so let's talk physically about the album because it comes out in 64, goes straight to number one. It knocks Hard Day's Night off the number one album spot in the UK. I've got a copy of the album in front of me right here. And what you kind of forget is it's a gatefold. It's a very attractive kind of album sleeve. So I don't think, you know, when you see it in album style, my CD of Beatles for Sale, which is how I first got the album, in the late 80s is...
We're seeing all the formats.
All the formats here. It's kind of unloved. I think it was one of the last Beatles albums I picked up. But yeah. you see that big picture on the album. It's a great cover. You realize that it's a gatefold and it's got quite an artsy collage going on inside. It's got those great Derek Taylor notes.
Yes. No, I think you're right. And I had this on vinyl before I had it on CD, but the copy I had was given to me by someone whose parents had given it to him. And yeah. it was a sort of tattered 1960s mono copy. The cover was creased. I kept it inside a plastic sleeve. So I didn't really appreciate the whole sort of package, the artwork and everything yeah. that was put together. And I'm pretty, yeah. It's a very lavish.
It's very lavish for 64, lavish, you know. It's,
for 64. Yeah. And again, EMI are throwing, obviously, you know, this is the golden goose. They're throwing money at this.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a very sophisticated package.
And the back doesn't have any text on it at all, which is also unusual.
It sort of prefigures this notion. We're getting to this idea of, you ultimately end up with Abbey Road where... There's nothing on the cover.
Yeah, I think if they'd been bold enough to actually do the cover with zero text.
Yeah.
And the text is doesn't really dominate the front cover.
No, it's quite discreet.
A totally blank cover would be fantastic. Derek Taylor's sleeve notes, we all love those, don't we?
These are absolutely brilliant sleeve notes. And it's Derek Taylor, a master of hyperbole. People, cigar smoking people on Saturn
yeah.
in the year 2000 will still love the warmth and excitement of this record. I think, we may not be smoking cigars, we may not be on Saturn, no. but I think we're enjoying the warmth of this record.
Well, Saturn is a gas planet, so I don't think we were never going to Saturn, but the rest of it, the general spirit.
I didn't say Derek was a good scientist, but he had a way with words.
But certainly his vibe that people in the future will be listening to this and
yeah.
lo and behold, here we are doing a big talk about it. So, but it, as I said, this notion of that it's not very good, we're kind of putting that to bed, but there probably are a couple of tweaks that could make it better. We've talked about Running Order. We've talked about putting on, Leave My Kitten Alone. The title, Beatles for Sale, it's an odd title.
Do you have a theory?
Yes. My theory is, because I've never heard a story as to why it's called Beatles for Sale.
No.
And I've heard people talk about, Beatles for Sale is the Beatles album where the Beatles just made albums like other people made albums with some new songs and some old songs and they just rushed it out. But Beatles for Sale, my theory is that they were trying to come up with an album title and it was their fourth album and they might have gone from Beatles 4.
Yeah.
And Beatles 4 was maybe, we call it Beatles 4. Hey, why not call it Beatles for Sale? That's my theory.
Okay.
That's
not just that they thought of themselves as being reduced to a commodity.
Well, I think the title does.
That was my assumption.
I think you're probably right, but I think the title adds to the notion that this is an album of jaded people. Beatles for Sale does sound a bit cynical, and we don't like cynical Beatles. They're not really known for being cynical in the way that, people can be, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think the big shift here is if you look at that Running Order.
Yeah.
So you open with No Reply.
Yeah.
I'm a Loser.
Yeah.
Babies in Black. Those are three
downers.
Downers and three Lennon vocals.
Yeah.
Rock and Roll Music is the up tempo again. Four Lennon songs in a row.
Yeah.
I'll Follow the Sun, Mr. Moonlight.
Yeah.
Kansas City.
Yeah.
That's not a Beatlemania toe tapping, up tempo, uplifting Running Order.
Yeah.
8 days a week on the B side, good opening to the B side. I think you're right. It would have made a good opener to the album.
Yeah.
Words of Love, Honey Don't is a bit of a.
The sleeve for Words of Love, by the way, says John and Paul quite clearly.
I
know them. That's
well, I would always have said John and Paul, but yeah. I noticed that Ian McDonald was crediting that to George. So
okay, then Honey Don't You?
Every Little Thing.
Yep.
Don't Want to Spoil the Party. What You're Doing, which I think is probably my favorite song.
It's lost there. It's
and it's completely lost at the back end of the album. Lost, but it's the most sophisticated thing they've done. It's a great Paul track.
Yeah.
It's a great studio track. And then you get Everybody's Trying to Be My Baby, which is a little sort of ho-hum. It's fine, yeah. But it's not a satisfactory closer.
Well, you know, if we're tweaking it and we're talking about, you know, what's wrong or what could be done, you know, from a box set point of view, I would like a little bit of sonic tweaking on this. Mm. Some of the vocals sound a little bit far back. I think some Abbey Road trickery could really make you rethink this album a little bit. I know there's probably not an awful lot in the vaults that could be added to it, and we've had Leave My Kitten Alone.
I think what you've got are a lot of session tapes. You know, there's a lot of bootlegs out there of Beatles for Sale.
Yeah, you could do a Bob Dylan complete Beatles for Sale sessions. That would be fun.
Yeah. I don't know. Do we want five takes of Honey Don't?
Yeah, we do actually.
Okay. Oh, okay. we'd buy that. We'd buy that.
But at the end of the day, just, you know, looking at Derek Taylor's notes here, he says, you know, here it is then. It definitely says John, Paul, George and Ringo, full of everything which made the four the biggest attraction the world has ever known. Like, he's writing that the year it happens.
Yeah.
Full of raw John and melodic Paul, a number from George and a bonus from Ringo. For those who like to know what's the details are along each title. But, you know, even then it's like raucous John, melodic Paul, George and Ringo are here too.
Yeah. We're totally codified.
We're
absolutely, they're locked into that that image.
So have we made a case for Beatles for Sale? I think there's a fantastic case for this fantastic album.
I think you're
want to run off and listen to it again.
I think you're absolutely right. And maybe it's because it's not an album with which we are overly familiar.
Yes, it's the Beatles album that we've kind of forgotten about. Every Beatles album has some kind of superlative attached to it.
Yes.
And this is the underestimated one or the most forgotten one or the most neglected one, you know?
So I think you're particularly the songs on the second side.
Yeah.
Let's get everybody who needs to get out, you know, listen to this album again.
Yeah.
I think it's ridiculous to say that any aspect of what the Beatles have done is undiscovered, but it's time to be rediscovered.
It is. Yes, it is to be rediscovered. And I think it's possible that there's people out there who, you know, there might be one or two gaps in their collection, and chances are the gaps are Beatles for Sale, you know, that it's not going to be Sgt. Pepper or the White Album.
No,
it's going to be Beatles for Sale. And if you've left it, you know, on the shop shelves, you know, go listen to Beatles for Sale. If you haven't listened to it for a while, go listen for Sale. We've said it time and again, our number one raison d'etre on this show is just to send you back to the records and go, yeah, they were the best. And, you know, Beatles for Sale is as good as any of it. It's part of the story. And, you know, don't let people put it down.
Yeah. I agree.
All right. So listen.
Everything that you said.
So look, Beatles for Sale, hopefully we'll send you back listening to that. What do you think? You know, let us know in all the usual places. We're happy to get involved. We're on Twitter @BeatlesPod. We are also on Facebook in the Facebook group. Stephen will let you in. We occasionally put stuff up on Instagram these days. And, you know, wherever you download or listen to us, we appreciate any nice reviews that you can leave behind for us on our behalf. But yeah, go off and listen to Beatles for Sale. It's great.
While you're all off rediscovering Beatles for Sale, we will be taking a short break. This has been the last episode of season 2. We'd like to thank everybody for their support, for the very kind comments and reviews and feedback, and just generally engaging across Facebook and Twitter. We really do appreciate all of your input. We're hoping to come back in early October with season 3. And if you have suggestions for areas or aspects of the Beatles story that you'd like us to cover, do get in touch.
But for Nothing Is Real this time, I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And this has been Nothing Is Real. Thanks for listening, folks. Nothing Is Real is powered by Acast.